Cool. So just for starters, the Baja California Peninsula, this is the peninsula that connects to California. It's right on the border. You all started your trips in San Diego, and it is this peninsula that goes down. It is part of Mexico, but does not connect to the mainland, or does it connect to the mainland at some weird juncture? Just barely.
You want to go, or you want me to? Yeah. So the Baja Peninsula does connect into Southern California, and it is all on its west coast is the Pacific Ocean. On its east coast is the Sea of Cortez, and of course the Colorado River flows into the Sea of Cortez. But the trip itself is a bike packing route that uses 16 to 1700 miles of old Jeep trails, some footpaths, mostly rural routes off of pavement that connect farming communities and small towns. And of course, it does link into some of Baja's larger towns as well. But yeah, the route itself does run from San Diego in California for about 60 miles in the States, crosses the Mexican border at Tecate, and from there it's another over 1500 miles of zigzagging back and forth across the peninsula, like I said, on those gravel roads and dirt trails mostly, all the way down to Cabo on the southern tip of the peninsula.
And to both of you all, when did you go and how long was your trip?
I'll let Nick start on that one, and he can tell you about his itinerary, then I'll give you mine.
Yeah, I flew into San Diego, and then Stephen flew in a day after me, fully unplanned. So that was pretty amazing that we were doing the same trip, just starting a day apart. So then, and Stephen had two buddies with him out of Canada. And so we were going to leave San Diego the same day, and I was staying at a hostel, and I didn't quite make it link up with Steven and them on time. So they took off to do the U.S. part, and we're going to meet up at the border there. And we had heard that there were a little bit of previous bikers had, I think it was the year prior, that they had a couple of incidents crossing Tecate there. So we're going to cross as a group just to kind of be safe. And but I had bike issues there before we got to the border, so I had to turn back around after linking up with Steven. And they took off ahead of me, and so I crossed the border, I think, 2 or 3 days afterwards, and then playing the catch-up game. And we kind of had a night where I think Steven and them might have watched me pass by one night. And so we kind of got separated again for a few more weeks. But my trip in total was about 5 weeks, I think, once I was going. And then Steven's got a little bit more addition to his, so he'll tell you about that.
Thanks, Nick.
Yeah, so I basically did the same route over 7 weeks. So I was on a little bit more of a leisure pace than Nick, and it was pretty funny because we were hoping to do some of the route together. And at about I started the route with two buddies, one of whom a lot of Wrangell folks know, Willie Hollett, and another old Crossings buddy of mine from 20 years ago. He was in Wrangell, Jeff Mill. So Willie and Jeff and I were together for the first 300 miles of the route, and had kind of, with Nick's initial bike issues, we didn't start out together, and then met up for one day and tried to work on his bike, and he ended up hitching back to San Diego to get that thing fixed. And then at about mile 200, Jeff and Willie and I are on the coast at that point, and we see way off in the sea an LED light, and there's a big argument between us about, I think that could be a bike light. Maybe that's Nick. I don't know. Maybe it's not Nick. And it was so far off and so in the distance, and then we didn't see it again, and we got distracted, conversation and hanging out and whatnot. We think Nick maybe went past us in the dark, and we didn't even realize it. Nick had his phone with him, and I had an inReach, so I could send satellite text messages out, so we were kind of keeping in touch that way. But a few more days down the road, realized Nick was in front of us, and then I eventually caught up to Nick on New Year's Eve day. I rolled into the town that he was kind of hanging out in. I finally caught up to him after a lot of miles of chasing him. And we got to spend New Year's Eve together and had a great time. There was a bunch, the town that we both were in for New Year's Eve was a town named Mulahay, and there were about 1,000 miles in, yep. And a handful of other cyclists were there, mostly European cyclists. We had a great celebration there, and I was actually linking up with my wife, Amber, at that point. So Nick motored on that day. So that was really the only time we were together was on New Year's Eve. Got to celebrate that together with a bunch of really kind folk. And then I, over the course of the next 3 weeks, finished the route out. But, yeah, I did about 7 weeks. I broke it down about of those 7 weeks. I think I was pedaling for about 5 of those, so about 2 weeks of rest days. I took lots of time off and got to enjoy some of the countryside. So I think I was averaging about 40 something miles a day to do the trip. Nick was probably, or you probably more like 60-ish. Yeah. So that was kind of my itinerary, June.
Yeah, and did you both fly out of Cabo?
Yes, I flew out of Cabo. You flew out as well. Yeah, we both flew out of Cabo.
Okay, and did you buy that return home ticket in advance? Was there ultimately a due date for you to be in Cabo?
You know, I just needed to be back to work on February the 1st, so that was my goal all along. I started the trip on December the 7th, I think, and just pedaled on and off until I kind of pacing myself and not wanting to go too fast, just see the country and enjoy it as much as I could. Here, I'll hand the phone over to Nick. You can ask him the same thing. Here, let me wipe it down with alcohol.
Hey, June.
Hey.
I kind of missed the question there.
Yeah, so I was just wondering if you were on a strict timeline, you know, you finished this in 5 weeks, did you have a goal of being in Cabo in 5 weeks?
No. So originally, I was going to only take about 3 weeks. I had work, a project that we were going to get started here in town that I thought I needed to get home for. And also, this is my third bike trip, and I kind of go out with the same mentality of point A to point B. And you know, that's, I think, kind of part of the, you know, the way we live our lives is we're so needing to get so much done. And every, you know, you have that mentality, or I have that mentality when I get there, go, 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 instead of, as I get there and I run into people and I meet people and I start to slow down and appreciate why I'm there and what I'm there for, and get out of that kind of mentality of just constant, you know, drive, I guess, and which is really a big part of what I get when I go on these, is it slows me down and makes me think and appreciate and be more in the moment as opposed to where we're trying to get to in life. So I think I went out the first 2 weeks pretty hard trying to catch up to Steve, and then just, I think when you're by yourself, you kind of, or for myself at least, I'm in that mentality of just go, go, go. Like I said, it's kind of point A to point B. And so I ran into a few different couples that I got to spend some time with and from different countries, which is really nice because you get to learn, you know, about the way that they live their life and what why they're doing it, and just you gain so much more from it, or I do, and the perspective than if you just got there and you just kind of just ran right through it. So I think in total, I planned 3 weeks and it took me five, and I think that was a perfect amount of time. So if I did it again, I'd tell somebody 5 or 6 weeks is probably a good time frame.
Okay, Nick, thank you. So, you know, I know that both of you all really enjoyed yourselves, and there's a lot of amazing, you know, positive experiences that you're taking. But, Nick, I'm curious, you know, since your trip started off with, you know, this rut, you know, did that continue on for you? What kind of adversity did you come up against?
Say that last part again.
Yeah. So, I mean, you had trouble just getting your bike past the border.
Uh-huh.
I mean, did that continue on into in Mexico? Did you run into some issues?
Yeah. So I was having a trouble with my rear hub, and it actually started when I was in San Diego there. And I had got some new tires, ones that I figured I would need to last on the Baja. And so I was actually riding my bike to REI to have it worked on and just maintenance in general. And I ended up having a pretty severe issue about a mile away from the REI. So I get there and they fix me up. They kept my bike. Fortunately, when they heard that I was doing the Baja, they were real great about getting me in, as opposed to I didn't realize. When you go somewhere busy like that, it's usually kind of like a car. You make an appointment and wait to get your bike in and serviced. So that was the initial, you know, and problem. And then so as I started and I got closer to Cate, the issue that was I thought fixed kind of started showing up more. My bike started making noises, and I just wasn't comfortable with going into Mexico with the issue, because we had a pretty good description of the route and services provided, and there was only one main bike shop that was really reliable, and that was about 300 miles in. So I made the decision to turn around, which is kind of tough. It's always tough to go backwards. So I went back to San Diego to a Trek dealership, and they told me it was going to be about 3 days. Luckily, the owner of the store had the same bike, so the next morning they gave me a call. They took the parts off his bike and put it on mine, which, again, you know, you feel kind of uneasy getting used parts from somebody else. But it got me going. The problem seemed fixed, and so I got going. The first 300 miles is probably the roughest, just real mountainous and real rocky trails that really just really beat the bike up. So 300 miles in, my bike was having issues again. They took my whole rear tire apart, and the guy tried taking the bearings out, which I guess they didn't want to come out, and he's banging on it with a hammer and a screwdriver. And then he tells me, well, I can't get them out. You're just going to kind of have to roll with it, you know, which, again, kind of throws me off when I see somebody banging on my bike. And so I got going. I broke a spoke and had to take it back to the guy and fix it again. So I was having that first couple hundred miles was I was definitely worried. I think something that long, you want to be really confident in your equipment, because, you know, you could get halfway, and if you have an issue, in that area of the country, you're kind of at square one. So it was tough at the beginning, but once I got more and more confidence in my bike, the trip got better, so... It was definitely shaky there at the beginning for me for a bit, and I was definitely cursing the Trek company and my bike and everybody that worked on it. And so But I wasn't the only one. I ran into another couple that had issues like that, and I think it's just kind of part of the journey. So it just made it that much more interesting.
Yeah, Nick, thank you. Yeah, I can see that would be nerve-wracking. I mean, what kind of, you know, for you or Stephen, you know, do give me a sense of how rural this area, you know, the peninsula is for the most part. You know, how often are you going through cities? What does the landscape look like? But what do the amenities look like throughout that journey?
Yeah, hey June, Stephen here. Very rural compared to most places in North America these days. A lot of the country that you're traveling through on the Baja Divide is up in the mountains, away from the towns, away from the tourist infrastructure, and a lot of areas where folks are kind of living a semi-subsistence farmer lifestyle. There were days where we would be going through the mountain passes, and you have to wait for herds of a couple of hundred goats to get out of your way, and then there'd be a kind gentleman on the side of the road, you know, walking with a shepherd dog and whatnot. The Baja Divide itself, the bikepacking route, has been laid out by, you know, some sponsored and professional bikers that have done an excellent job of mapping out the resources along the way. But it does take a lot of planning and understanding, not only how far, not only the distance and the terrain between the towns or the villages where you're resupplying, and you have all of that information. Anybody that does a trip like this these days has the information downloaded into their phone with a map, or they're using a GPS unit with a map that tells you how many miles to the next resupply point. But what's just as important as knowing that information is also knowing your capabilities as a rider and knowing how long it's going to take you to get there, how long you want it to take you to get there, and just making sure that you have the water, of course, first and foremost is the most important, is making sure you've got the correct amount of liters to get you over those miles, and then having the grub to get you there as well. So that's always a balance, and with anything, whether you're biking or climbing a mountain or whatever, you're making sure that you have the food, the weight of the food and water is not slowing you where you're spinning your wheels and becoming inefficient and breaking down and not getting there. But
yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting that, you know, the peninsula sounds like, yeah, it's very rural and remote in some ways, but this trip has been done by bikers. You know, I'm assuming you guys went there to bike because you had heard people bike there. So that's interesting.
Yeah, and on that note, I was going to say, too, the folks that laid the trip out are actually Alaskan folks. One of them is a well-known cyclist, endurance athlete named Lael Wilcox. She was one of the pioneers of this route. And there's the bikepacking community is a sport that's really taken off in the last 5 or 10 years, and it has a really strong presence in Alaska. A lot of folks have gravitated towards this type of non-motorized travel and getting around in other countries. So The Alaskan, there's a lot of Alaskan cyclists that are at the forefront of this sport.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe you can just tell me, you know, briefly, why was this something you both wanted to do?
Yeah, I'll go first. I'll kind of dovetail off of what Nick was saying. Just to me, I'm just attracted to cycle trips or canoe trips where I'm getting to see big chunks of backcountry, you know, by muscle power and kind of living in the moment. It allows me to take trips at my own pace and get to know folks along the way. I was very lucky with this trip. I had a nice mix of doing it with a few hundred miles with my partner Amber and a few hundred miles with some really good friends. But then I also did about 800 miles of the total trip I did solo. And that was the perfect mix for me. I really like solo traveling and kind of recalibrating thought processes and plans for the future. When you're on a cycle for 10 hours a day for several days in a row, just depending on only your wits and your capacity, it gives you the chance to kind of clear your head and clear out a few cobwebs and get ready for what's ahead. So for me, that's what bike tripping or a paddle trip or a walk in the woods is all about. But I'll pitch it over to Nick here.
Yeah, kind of what Steven said, but I mean, there's so much that I get out of it, it's hard to just kind of outright lay it out. But I really enjoy traveling. This pace is great because, walking or hiking, especially a distance like this, it takes so long. And as in a car, a vehicle, it seems like it's that point A to point B, but you're not really what's in between. And you're not, I don't feel appreciating it quite as much as, you know, when you're on a bike, you go up a hill or a mountain, you feel that, you remember it. It kind of sears in your memory. And you're in the elements, if it's raining, if it's cold, if it's whatever, you're more feeling it and you're getting more senses on it than if you were traveling by vehicle and just kind of, you know, and you're not interacting with the people quite so much and you're not getting that time. I think they call it flow, but when you're just kind of in your own head and you get to do what I think you don't get to do a lot of in society, which is live in the moment and really be in your head and kind of solve your inner problems or reflect on things that you'd be so distracted with in the real world. And so I'd say that's a lot of why I get to do it. And then, you know, my first bike trip was up north, and it was kind of the same thing, a lot of seclusion and such, and I really enjoyed that. So I went on a second one, and it was on the coast in the lower 48. And I enjoyed that, but I didn't like how much I was still in society and around so many people and on the roads. And so bike packing, especially with the new gear they're coming out with, really allows you to go on these extended trips while getting out and away into the more remote areas.
Yeah, and you're saying, you know, having some of that seclusion lets you be in the moment, lets you get away from society. I mean, how often were you, you know, how truly in the moment were you? When were you thinking about what's going on at home, even what's going on in the U.S.? And when were you just totally not, that was, could not be further away?
Well, you know, actually, that's the thing about an extended trip is it for myself, it probably actually took about 2 weeks before I really left a lot of what was at home and that, that 100-mile-an-hour thought process. It took me a few weeks to finally kind of shed all of that off and be in the moment, I guess, and really take what I was there for what it was. And I'd say, like Steven was saying, the solo time, that's the most important time for myself because that's the time, you know, that you really – go into yourself, and especially on something like this, once you get in a rhythm of, you kind of get in a cycle, I feel like.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. And then, I mean, as I met people, It wasn't quite. It was certainly a different experience. It wasn't better or worse. You know, you get to share the moments with people and kind of reflect on it together, and then get that sense of community of sharing their world with yours and vice versa. So, but I'd say the solo times were the times when I'd really kind of go into myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, June, I was actually just sitting here thinking about your question and something else on a cycle trip or any type of outdoor adventure where there's a technical component. Another time when you're really in the moment and you're not thinking about what's going on in the world around you or relationships or communication or anything else, it's when things are technically tough. Like when you're going down a really steep section of mountain on a bike, you're not thinking about politics in the USA. You're thinking about that boulder that you don't want to hit, or you're thinking about that gully that you don't want to get sidewalled in. Or if you're climbing a really tough section of mountains, you're not thinking about anything else except the incline and how you're going to deal with it and pace yourself with your energy and the capacity you have. But it's those flat sections, you know, if you get on some rolling country and the scenery's nice, then those are the times on a bike, at least, that you can you've got that contemplation time. That's the same with paddling or climbing or any pursuit where there's technical components. A lot of times it's the world around you that's going to allow you to focus on what you're doing, or be able to kind of have that time to contemplate.
Yeah, Stephen, thank you. I really appreciate that. So I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I would like to talk about, you know, people, and I would like to talk about nature, and maybe if both of you guys could think about, you know, one time that really stood out to you when you said, wow, this landscape is so interesting, or it's so beautiful, or it's so barren. What's a moment where the landscape just really took you? And then also, you know, who was a person you met along the way that you will remember and, you know, you had a good time with, or they irritated you, or anything?
Go first, you want me?
Yeah. I guess one thing I don't know if I'd use the word worried, but was kind of curious about before I started was, this wouldn't have normally been a trip that would have kind of been too seductive, but it just happened to be the timing of when I was available and the time of year that this happened to, you know, in the winter, there's not a lot of areas that you can go do something like this. So I think that's kind of why the Baja is getting the appeal it does. Because it's somewhere people can go get this experience in the wintertime. So I kind of thought maybe this trip was going to be a lot of the same terrain and the same features, and kind of after a while I kind of wondered if it would be more about trying to finish it out than it would be still appreciating quite so much, you know, what was around me. And that surprised me the most, I think, was how much it actually, the landscape changed. We went from the mountains to the ocean and back and forth. And so I would say it's hard to pick any one moment. I certainly had some favorite spots. It's pretty neat when you're in the desert and you find a place that's really an oasis and it's out in the middle of nowhere. And it's like this golden gem in the, you know, outskirts of nowhere. And that was always really amazing. Or being up on a mountain and just taking it all in, the canyons and the greenery. I was surprised at how lush the desert was in some areas. And,
yeah, can you explain a little bit more, like the oasis in a desert, you know, is that it means a spring is shooting up from the ground? It means a town is, gathered in that area? What does that look like?
It's more, I think the lushness of, I was surprised at how much different the diversity of vegetation was there, especially in some areas more than others. I think that, yeah, that's probably the biggest part. I mean, I don't know if the landscape changes so much more. Now, I hear it gets pretty out. I don't think we were there when there was much blossoming going on. I hear it gets pretty colorful when it blossoms. But, I mean, other than that.
Yeah. Yeah, and any... Yeah,
I was going slow enough, I think, behind Nick. I think I caught some of those blossoms because I think the bloom happened... It was happening right towards the end when I was kind of behind, and I did luck into a bunch of beautiful flowers. And then one other kind of answered one of your questions. I think I could hear you say in June was asking about just specifics and people, and like very poignant day. It also kind of relates to your asking about struggles and whatnot. Most of my days were just fantastic, just like, you know, happy and loving life the whole day. It did have one really bad day. It started with, I was going into one of the most remote areas, and a family came up in a truck behind me, and real friendly people, and invited me to dinner when I got to their house on the coast, and I was about 30 miles out, and they were in a white Ford Ranger. And so when I got to this little village, there was only about 20 houses in the village. I went up to have dinner with his family, and I saw in the distance, I saw a white Ford Ranger parked at a house. So I went through a gate and went around the truck to knock on the door. And there's a giant dog on the porch that I hadn't seen. It happened to be a pit bull, and it latched onto my ankle and got some pretty good punctures.
Wow.
from the dog bite. So I go from this, you know, blissful experience and so excited and happy for this hospitality to getting bit by this dog. Come to find out, I went to the wrong house with the wrong white Ford Ranger. Of course, it wasn't the right house. And so it turned into a pretty scary moment, pretty good wounds on my ankles. And luckily, I had enough disinfectant in my kit that I was able to scrub it out really good. And I lucked out and just didn't get an infection, but pretty terrible pit in your stomach thinking your trip's over, because I was thinking the odds were, I'm going to have to get out of there because this ankle's probably going to get infected. Luckily that didn't happen. It healed up and I had scrubbed it out enough, but I went from this really bad feeling to then finding the right house with, Teresa and Oscar were the name of the couple that invited me for dinner. And they were, of course, so worried about my wounds and were helping me clean them up. And then he was a lobster man and had lobster traps out. So they fried me a big lobster dinner and abalone soup. So I went from like one of the low points of the trip to one of the memories that I'll always have just due to this very kind couple. And that was a story for me throughout Baja. The people were absolutely fantastic. In the rural areas, of course, in the city, it's a city, so there's always seedy people in the city, and people can be a little more edgy there. But anywhere, this trip, 95% of it's very rural and in very rural parts of the country. And I can say to a person, everybody I met in the rural areas had a smile on their face. They were happy to see me, wanted to talk with me. My Spanish is very limited, and I did my best to converse and relate things, but just absolute kindness from the folks in the rural area. It was astounding how nice everybody was, and happy to see me when I rolled in.
Yeah, I think, you know, traveling is very much so about the people you meet. Definitely the most memorable parts for me are the people you meet. And I'm wondering, you know, with the dog incident, I mean, how did you process that? You know, did you think, wow, I was maybe not being as cautious as I should have been? I mean, because this whole trip is has stakes and it has risks. Anytime you travel, especially on your own, it has risks. I mean, did you reassess, you know, your risk taking?
Well, I just mostly didn't walk into somebody's yard and automatically assume that I was walking into the right place with the right white Ford Ranger, I guess. I just did something stupid there. I wasn't really paying attention, and there were dogs along the way. Most of them were more often the bigger problem was with dogs when you would stop in a little village plaza with it, was they wanted to jump in your lap and eat your sandwich or your tortilla. But I had let my guard down for a minute with that and just walked into a gate where I wasn't paying attention. But you're exactly right. When you are in very rural areas in a foreign country, again, that's just part of capacity and understanding the risks that are involved. But, you know, there's risks with everything we do. We get out on the water in Southeast Alaska, there's risks. You get on an interstate in the lower 48, there's risks. We as human beings are constantly assessing those. And on a bike trip in a foreign country, you just have to do your homework ahead of time. Listen to folks that have done the trip before you, but also not overreact to stereotypes and perceptions that we may have of other countries as well. And just do your homework and look at the data and look at the science and talk to folks that have done it versus the hype and the stereotypes that might be surrounded around a particular region or a particular country. So overall, you know, this trip was a very safe trip. The bigger danger was flying over your handlebars and breaking your clavicle than anything else. So just being careful on the technical parts of the ride and a couple of places and a couple of cities where you didn't want to turn down the wrong street, but the cities were few and far between, and most everything else was pretty tranquilo.
Yeah. Thank you, Stephen. Those are all good words, and you know what you're saying about, you know, not to play off of any stereotypes when you're going to foreign countries. I mean, it's just going to really, people, you know, are really limiting themselves to maintain those in their minds because, traveling is probably better than having stereotypes. So we can end our conversation here shortly. So just any parting words, really, at this point?
Yeah, you know, I'd like to add on kind of what you guys are talking about, the stereotypes. Is it's interesting how, you know, I hadn't been to Mexico and you know, kind of this, of course, getting the stereotypes and then myself crossing the border. And I noticed that my initial crossing, you know, I felt kind of insecure and the fears and such with me. And it felt like the further south I got, almost the more friendlier the people became and the more open they became. But I'm curious to know if that was my own fears and insecurities staring back at me. And then as I became more comfortable and intertwined with the people, I was able to open up and let go of those, you know, potential stereotypes that I had coming across. And so that was something I would, you know, I just like to express for people to understand, you know, as I think that's all it was you go into an area like that. And I think of a lot of what we feel is our own, you know, something within ourselves, not so much something that's coming off of those people.
Yeah, absolutely, Nick. Thank you. And anything else you would like to say before we part?
I would highly recommend this trip to anybody that, you know, that likes adventure. And I mean, it was just, it's such a great trip. It's hard to put it into words, really how it was. So, but yeah, here's Stephen.
Thank you, Nick.
What was the question? Sorry.
This is just parting words, honestly.
Yeah. Okay. Parting words. Let's see. Yeah. Just what Nick says, if you like to ride a bike and you like to experience other cultures and learn about desert flora and fauna, this is the trip for you. So I'm sure Nick and I know myself, we'd be happy to chat with anybody that's interested in hearing more about it, and also give a shout out to the, if anybody wants to read about the trip online, just go to bikepacking.com, find the map that's on that really great website. You'll see on that map, you'll see the Baja Peninsula, of course. Click on the trail. It goes right down the middle of it, and it'll take you to a fantastic link about this trip that'll tell you everything you want to know. Great photography, all the data on the trip itself. So bikepacking.com, go to the map, click on Baja, you'll find it. The other thing I just wanted to say was I had a lot of help getting prepared for this trip, a lot of good advice, a lot of good friends, bike riders that done a lot more biking than I have, and then some fantastic bike businesses. And I think in this era of what we as a nation are going through, what the world is going through, we got to keep in mind our small businesses. And the bike business is made up of small businesses. And MulberryGap.com, they happen to be family of mine, but they're the folks that got me on the bike that I rode. And then I had some new wheels built up by the local bike shop in Haines, Sockeye Cycle, fantastic bike mechanics and a bike company there. And then once we got down to San Diego, of course, last-minute stuff with Jeff and Willie and I, we found a bike shop down there named Cal Coast Bicycles that just, like, went out of the way. They heard we were doing the Baja Divide, went out of their way to bump us to the front of the line, and fix us up and get us going. But the bicycle community, the folks that run these small businesses are, you know, we couldn't do these adventures without them. So if you're a cyclist, support them. If you're a climber, find your local climbing shop. If you're a paddler, look for those folks that sell those specialty items and have those handmade businesses and support them, because those of us that do these kind of quirky adventure trips, we've got to find ways to support these businesses, especially in this era.
Okay, Stephen, thank you so much for coming online, and Nick, same to you, and, you know, take care, and
thanks, June.
Yeah, I'm so glad you guys got to do this before the world shut down.
Yeah, absolutely.
So important for everybody else out there to know, you know, if you want to do something, go ahead and do it, because you don't know what tomorrow will bring. All right. Peace out, guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks, June.
Mm-hmm.
All right.